Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to us. This week, the difference that's made when families and communities get involved in education, a public-private partnership to support student mental health, and a nonprofit that's helping girls of color learn important life skills and gain self-confidence. First, in a recent article in the Lexington Herald-Leader, accountability reporter John Cheeves tells us that Kentucky is slowly reducing a huge pandemic-era backlog of annual inspections of nursing homes, most of them owned by private for-profit corporations with 20,000 very vulnerable adults in their care. But, he continues, it still has a far way to go, and residents are at risk. He's here to share his findings. Welcome back to Eastern Standard, John.
Thank you for having me, Tom. I appreciate it.
So some improvement on the annual inspection front. Let's talk about that first. Inspections were stalled by the pandemic. Is that correct?
That's right. So every year, every state in the country is supposed to send a team of surveyors out to all of the nursing homes and do a multi-day in-depth inspection to check on the quality of care being offered to their residents. This is done not just because it's the right thing to do, but because public money is at stake. Medicare and Medicaid funding is what primarily pays for nursing homes in this country. In Kentucky, it's the Division of Healthcare at the Cabinet for Health and Family Services. That's the agency that the federal government has a contract with to go out and hit all 269 of our nursing homes every year, make sure they're doing a good job. Well, during the COVID-19 pandemic, as you remember, the virus spread just terribly, and it sickened and killed a lot of people, residents and staff at the nursing homes. And so for about a year there in 2020, 2021, the federal government said, hang on a minute, put the usual annual standard surveys on hold, focus on infection control, infection prevention. And that's what all the states did. And by 2021, the vaccine was being rolled out. Things were starting to get a little back to normal, and they said, all right, go ahead and resume these annual inspections. Well, by then, there was a backlog. Every state had a backlog of nursing homes now that had not been inspected in a while. Kentucky had a bigger backlog than most, and unfortunately, here we are, four going on 5 years later, and the backlog has remained. When I did my first story back in the summer of 2023, nearly three-fourths of the nursing homes, 73%, had gone at least 2 years without an annual inspection. When my most recent story ran in December, it was better. We were at 53%, but still more than half of the nursing homes in Kentucky had gone at least 2 years without an annual inspection. Some of them hadn't been checked since before the pandemic. So surveyors back in 2024, last year, we're just getting into nursing homes for the first time, in some cases, since 2019, early 2020. They'd gone 3 or 4 years without, you know, setting foot in these nursing homes to see what kind of health and services were being offered.
Well, you cite as an example of a nursing home going uninspected for a long, long time, Signature Healthcare at Summerfield Rehab and Wellness Center in Louisville. Tell us more about what was going on at Signature.
So here we have a 165-bed nursing home in Louisville. It went nearly 52 months between so-called annual inspections, and you could see the difference. So when state surveyors had last gone in 2019, it already had problems. They'd cited it for six health deficiencies. When they went back in January of 2024, they found 17 health deficiencies. And they levied a $12,000 fine. So they found, more significant problems. And I found this again and again in my reporting. I spoke to families who had loved ones at some of these nursing homes that had gone 3, 4, 5 years between inspections. And they said, boy, they didn't know that the place had gone so far between inspections. But they said you could tell the quality had really declined. They might have had a different loved one who had been in this nursing home before. Or they might have had a loved one in this nursing home over a period of years, but they could say, you could really tell 2022, 2023, this place just got worse and worse. It smelled worse. The staffing got worse. People never got out of their beds. They'd push the call button next to their beds and no help would ever come. And they said it just baffled us. Why did this place get so much worse? One of the reasons is that nobody from the state was going in to catch the problems. And again, you can tell because when the surveyors were going out, they're often finding just a ton of problems, just this long laundry list of issues. You know, one of the nursing home experts told me, how would you feel if you went to your favorite restaurant and that little sign from the County Board of Health indicating that they'd passed the sanitation test was last dated 2019? You wouldn't feel really good about eating there, would you? Well, that's the case with some of these nursing homes that we're putting our loved ones in.
The inspection situation is now improved, is it? Is it the curve heading up? How does it look now?
It's slowly getting better, but it's so slowly. It could be years before Kentucky eliminates its backlog of nursing home inspections. And one of the biggest problems is we don't have the staff. Again, the federal government, which pays the Medicare and Medicaid money, is ultimately responsible for doing the nursing home inspections, but it contracts it out to the states. And the state of Kentucky does not have enough surveyors. For years, it's had a shortage, particularly of the registered nurses, the RNs, who lead these survey teams. Governor Beshear's administration has slowly been raising payroll, has been trying to raise salaries. But it just can't compete with the private sector where nurses can command, you know, in some cases, six-figure salaries at hospitals and medical practices. A lot of the surveyors have quit and they've not been able to find enough people to replace them. And it's one of the reasons you can't send out survey teams without the surveyors.
Well, you do report that there still are concerns and that the nursing home industry in Kentucky still has a way to go. And residents are still at risk. How is that? How are residents still at risk? What sort of things are threatening?
I found a lot of problems. I mean, one of the biggest is just because of constant understaffing, folks never leave their beds when they should actually have activities. They should be getting dressed and taken to meals and taken to recreation. They never leave their beds. They're not moved, and so they get pressure sores. They're incontinent, and no one changes their adult, you know, bladder garments. The smell, the odor of just their, you know, lying in their own filth is terrible. People fall down because there's no one to assist them to the bathroom or into a wheelchair. There, in some cases, has been abuse. Residents have hurt each other. Staff have stolen from residents. There was a case in Louisville where a staff member actually set fire to a resident's room because he was annoyed at the guy for making what he felt was too many demands on the staff member, making too many requests on his time. The problem is that you just do not have the folks monitoring the nursing homes on a regular basis. And also, as another expert told me, there's such turnover. The employees come and go so quickly. Even the administrators come and go so quickly. There's sort of an education function to these surveyors. It's not really their job to teach the nursing home staff how to do their job. That's not what they're there for. But realistically, it kind of is what they do. When they're there for several days doing these surveys every year, they will say, hey, this is how you handle the food. This is how you handle the medicine. This is how you're supposed to help people to the bathroom. That is part of what they do. They try to help correct what they see as bad behavior. And when there's no one there, the nursing homes are left entirely to their own devices, and that's clearly not working.
If you just joined us, we're talking with John Cheeves, government accountability reporter at the Lexington Herald Leader. John, based on what you heard from Sherry Culp, she's the state's long-term care ombudsman, you report that small problems in a nursing home can escalate into widespread systemic failures. And when nobody is watching, what does that look like?
Well, again, one of the things I would point out to you is a problem with pressure sores. So if you don't have people on staff moving folks around in their beds, getting them out of their beds, they develop pressure sores. One of the complaints I heard from loved ones of nursing home residents was that nobody ever moved them. Nobody ever got them out of their bed. They spent all day in their pajamas just lying there sort of listlessly. Alternatively, in all sympathy for the nursing home employees, they were so overworked and understaffed, you'd have one or two people working an entire floor with a couple dozen residents, and they would say it's all we could do to pass out medication and, you know, get everyone their meal trays. You know, this you see advertising sometimes for, you know, senior living, and they show this old woman sitting on her bed staring at the sunset out the window while a nurse's aide rubs her back lovingly and they talk about the old days. That's a complete illusion at a lot of these places. At a lot of these places, there's almost no one-on-one, you know, care. And you can sit there and push the call button on you all you want. Nobody's coming. And it's just such a nightmare in a lot of cases. Again, 80% of the nursing homes in Kentucky, they're run by private, for-profit corporations, often large chains based in other states. There's a big profit motive there. And they don't have enough employees. As I also reported as a sidebar to this story, last April, the federal government did hand down what a lot of nursing home industry critics have long wanted, which is minimum staffing standards, requiring more employees to be hired by these nursing homes. And it would be phased in over several years with exemptions in rural areas. And if nursing homes just could not find enough staff, but it would finally start to solidify this need to have more employees on duty, more direct care nursing employees on duty. And a lot of states, including Republican Attorney General Russell Coleman here in Kentucky, have sided with the nursing home industry in fighting this in a couple of federal district court challenges.
Well, where does the accountability fall then? Were officials in the state health cabinet, for example, who these are folks who are responsible for nursing home inspections, were they willing to talk with you about it?
Sadly, no. For the second time in a row, Governor Beshear's Health and Family Services cabinet would not grant interviews. They would not talk about this. In public statements to the legislature last year, after my first stories ran, they acknowledged this is a big problem, and it's going to take years to get out of it. One curious thing, the state official who was in charge of regulating and inspecting the nursing homes, it's the inspector general. It's the Office of Inspector General at the state health cabinet. For the first term of Governor Beshear's administration, it was a guy named Adam Mather. And Adam Mather had been with the Signature Nursing Home chain. He'd been a vice president at their corporate headquarters in Louisville. So Governor Beshear hired Mr. Mather, this nursing home executive, to run the Office of Inspector General, regulating and inspecting the nursing homes. This all went kablooey. And then at the start of last year, Mr. Mather left the Inspector General's office and became the top nursing home lobbyist in the state of Kentucky. He took over the Kentucky Association of Healthcare Facilities in Frankfort, which is the nursing home industry lobbying group. So now he's revolved back through the revolving door again, and now he represents the nursing home's interests at the state capitol as a lobbyist. He's a registered lobbyist now. Mr. Mather's never spoken to me about any of this. He hasn't returned my calls or emails, but you just have this very friendly, cozy relationship between, you know, the state health regulators and the healthcare industry they're supposed to be regulating.
Well, John, if, as you report, most of Kentucky's nursing homes are owned and run by private for-profit corporations, is the state limited in what it can do to make sure that these places are taking good care of people?
If it would actually get inspectors out more regularly, at least under the current Biden administration, it has the authority to levy fines, financial penalties, civil monetary penalties, which I know the nursing homes take seriously. I will tell you, previously, under the Trump administration, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services told the inspectors to lay off the fines, to have more of a partnership with the nursing home industry, and it reduced the size of fines. It reduced the times you could issue fines. I would suspect under Dr. Oz, I think, the incoming CMS director under President Trump, we're going to see a return to that. We're going to see the inspections sort of watered down and weakened, assuming you can get inspectors out at all. So the next 4 years are going to be sort of a interesting time to be in a nursing home in Kentucky and in the United States generally. But there are teeth that the state of Kentucky could use to keep standards up if they actually would be paying attention to what goes on inside the nursing homes.
And I take it you're going to be following these developments?
I'll continue to. I mean, this is a subject. Honestly, the problem is not enough Kentuckians care, not enough people in the legislature care, not enough people in the state executive branch care, but these are among our most vulnerable Kentuckians, most of them older, although not all of them. They deserve to live with dignity and respect and not just be warehoused somewhere and forgotten about.
All right, that's Herald Leader, government accountability reporter John Cheeves, and we only skimmed the surface of his in-depth report on the state of nursing homes in Kentucky. If you want to know more, a link to John's article is on our homepage along with this interview. Just go to eswku.org. Thanks for joining us, John.
Thank you, Tom.
This year, the Biden administration handed down a rule requiring better staffing at nursing homes starting in 2026, but it's not clear if that will survive the changing of the guard in Washington. And Kentucky, meantime, has joined 19 other states in a nursing home industry lawsuit challenging the rule, calling it an unfair burden. Coming up after the break, how it truly does make a difference when families and communities get involved in education, bringing mental health care to school settings where kids feel more comfortable, and helping girls of color find their voices and themselves. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
When you support WEKU, you are making it possible to produce programs like Eastern Standard, focusing on Central and Eastern Kentucky, what the regions share in common, and what makes each distinctive. Featuring interviews by host and editor Tom Martin and a growing roster of contributors, Eastern Standard is professionally produced by sound designer and technical director Neil Kesterson. This weekly current affairs program is made possible by your support of WEKU. You can join our community of supporters by calling 800-621-8890 or contributing online at WEKU.org. The WEKU Daily News Podcast is now available for download. It's available weekday afternoons and includes the top five stories of the day. The WEKU News Podcast is available on the WEKU app, Apple, Spotify, and WEKU.org.
You're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU. I'm Tom Martin. There is a body of research that shows that when families and communities get involved in education, school attendance goes up, and that can lead to higher academic achievement. But making community engagement actually happen can be a challenge. Education contributor Bridget Blom tells us that in Kentucky, educators and administrators are taking some unique approaches to engaging their communities so that our kids are getting the skills they need to navigate an ever-evolving economy.
One of those educators is Dr. Brian Kreisman, superintendent of Fleming County Schools in Kentucky. He's also Kentucky's 2020 Superintendent of the Year. Dr. Kreisman has also written several books on leadership and education that he's clearly putting to work in Fleming County. Dr. Kreisman, welcome to Eastern Standard.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Brian, more and more educators are recognizing the value of parent and community engagement in removing barriers to student success and supporting enhanced student outcomes. Tell us about your efforts to engage community members and families in Fleming County schools and what you feel has been working the last couple of years.
Yeah. So, Bridget, one of the things that we do the typical community engagement things such as, PTA open houses or data nights. But one of the things that we have learned post-COVID, because I think after COVID, everything changed in terms of engagement, is that it really helped us learn that parents really like Zoom, these virtual meetings. And I know during COVID, we had a lot of these virtual town halls where we allowed parents to, log in from home, and we would educate them about how we would reopen school. And we continue to do things like that. And the reason we know it works is because a lot of our parents are getting home about six. That way they could just stay at home, fix dinner, take care of the kids, and not have to come back out to schools or the events. But those kind of things that we are learning are working really well. And also those traditional things, even though they're very traditional, those PTA open houses, those data nights, those are still critical because of that one-on-one parent and teacher engagement and interaction. But I think what in public education, I think we just have to keep evolving and learning. And, you know, I know a lot of our schools, our Simons Middle School here, they do YouTube weekly newsletters, and they release them on Sundays just to educate parents about the upcoming week. So technology has really helped us evolve into what community and parent engagement looks like in Fleming County.
So give us a sense of the types of virtual conversations that you're engaging parents in, but also the community, as you have been working to better understand the community's demands of public education today.
Yeah, so Bridget, that's a great question. And just here recently, when with our local accountability model, we launched our local accountability council, and that's made up of community members, that's made up of parents, that's made up of teachers. Our first meeting was virtual, but it opened up more avenues for people to engage. But all those conversations now are us listening, Bridget. We're not telling, we're listening to try to make sure that we're designing a school system, but also an accountability model that truly captures the community's you know, big rocks that they want us to make sure our kids walk out of Fleming County High School with those skills, those durable skills. And I think it's really changing the way we look at community engagement, and it's becoming less transaction and more transformational because, honestly, we're listening more. We're trying to educate, but we're listening to make sure that, you know, we're capturing exactly what the community wants, and also parents.
Now, what types of things are you hearing from community members, and how might that differ from what you're hearing from families and parents?
Bridget, I know you're big on this, just like I am, these durable skills. They want kids, yes, reading and writing and math are remain important, but I rarely hear about test scores. I hear all the time our kids need to be able to communicate. They need to have those face-to-face, eye-to-eye contact conversations. They need to have work ethic. They need to have those innovative skills to be creative. They need those problem-solving skills. And they may not know what those look like right now, but they know that they've got to have those skills. They want kids who are walking out of Fleming County High School with those skills to have a life of learning. You don't hear that often as a 21st century durable skill, that skill to know how to learn and keep learning and adapt, but they want that. And that's what we're hearing, and that's how we're trying to design a local accountability system that really captures that. But they also want schools that are more responsive, that, you know, we're not so rigid, and that we can adapt quickly to a changing demographic. Here in Fleming County, we're big on farming, agriculture, but that's changing because less and less of our students are going into farming after high school and after college. So it's changing, and you're hearing that from parents. They're not scared. They just want our school system to be more adaptable to the changing demands that they're seeing, and they're also hearing their friends in other counties talk about.
So you've taken all of this information that you've received from families, from the community, and you've put it into something that Fleming County and other school districts in the state refer to as a portrait of a graduate or a portrait or profile of a learner. So describe that for us, and what are the components of Fleming County's portrait or profile?
We started our work with our portrait of a learner back in 2016, and through that, we really focused on the community. We had a lot of focus groups. We did a lot of surveys throughout the year, the 16-17 school year, trying to find those competencies, those skills that we would bring into our portrait of a learner. We refer to our portrait of a learner as the bridge performance indicators because Fleming County is the covered bridge capital of Kentucky. And we're also playing on that. We're trying to bridge today to the future. And ours is problem solving, service, communication, innovation and creativity, and growth and achievement. And one of the things we do a little different But there's other districts across the state who do this as well. We have a beautiful poster that is in all of our classrooms and through our common areas in our buildings. But we really bring those skills off the wall and really embed them into learning. And we expect students to show grade level mastery of those competencies starting as early as kindergarten and all the way through 12th grade. And we artifact those. So our students can show parents using their what we call BPI websites, their competency learning for the year. And that's another way that we've really engaged parents differently. Instead of just sending a report card, we can actually show them what students are doing in terms of these competencies. And it's really powerful, Bridget, when you bring in, especially in grades 3, 6, 8, and 12, parents into these grade level promotion requirement grades. And the students are talking about their year of learning through their competencies. And seniors, typically, they always get teary-eyed, right? The parents, but and then the kindergarten passion projects, we couldn't keep parents out of the schools if we wanted to. Parents that typically will not come to school, they will come to these passion projects and listen to their kindergarten students. But it's our way of connecting, saying, you know, it's not your typical learning. It's not ABCD, right? It's about something that they really care about. Like I've said in on many that the kid is talking about Lego blocks or learning how to bake with grandma or whatever, but it's helping us to tell the parents, hey, we care about your kid's interests, passions, and aspirations, and we're trying to design learning around that.
Brian, you tell a really interesting story that I've heard a couple times now that I want you to share with us, and that's around the use of the OSHA manual.
Yes. So this has gotten around Kentucky, and it's a true story. So back in 2019, right before COVID, we had a group of senior welders who were failing senior English. They would not miss a day of welding. They would come to welding, and then the following period, they would skip out because senior English was right after that. So the principal came to us with this idea of we've got to do something, or we're going to have like 20 of these welders not graduate because they didn't have their senior English. So the principal got very creative, and she looked at the senior English standards, and she worked with the senior English teacher and said, hey, let's throw out all the traditional English novels or English textbooks, and let's bring in something that's dealing with welding that we know would meet 12th grade reading levels, and let's see what would happen. So it shouldn't surprise anyone, but it did surprise us at the time. The seniors started coming to senior English because they were learning senior English through the OSHA manual, which if you look at the OSHA manual, it has a Lexile score of 1,300. So that's a really high Lexile score. But if you look at those welders' state test scores or the ACT, you would think they were illiterate because it was not reflective of what their abilities were. So they graduated, right? But they also walked out with their OSHA certification. Our English teacher actually became a certified forklift driver because she engaged with them. She learned it, so she got engaged with it. But it just makes us really rethink, how are we really looking at reading ability or math ability or writing ability? And that's one of the things that we're really trying to do with that local accountability model is, yes, and I've said it before, reading, math, and writing is still very important with our local accountability model. But what we're looking at is, can we maybe make reading more interesting to kids, make math more interesting, and make writing based on their interests or passions or aspirations? And can we see if they can really read or do math or write at grade level? And it has really changed the conversation.
Yeah, wonderful story, I think, of that just encapsulates rigor, relevance, and relationship. And those welders are better off for Fleming County's flexibility around them and getting them off to a strong start on their post-high school pathway. So, Brian, as you reflect on the work the last couple years, what's changed in Fleming County when it comes to the district's relationship with families and communities and the relationship of families and communities with the school district?
So if I had to characterize it, I think it's more responsive, Bridget. I think we're more responsive because I think COVID really woke up a lot of school districts. It showed us that we really need parent support. And, you know, during that time, everything was just turned upside down, right? It really made us really think that we have to be more responsive in Fleming County to our parents. And by doing that, I think we engage them in ways that's more meaningful to them. And we're not just trying to check a box that we had an open house or a data night, or we had this many volunteers over the school year. And I think that you know, working with Pritchard, Bridget, you all have really helped us realize that, yeah, those volunteer hours are really important. But how is that really changing the outcomes for kids and also those relationships that we have with their parents in our community? So I think it's responsive both ways, that we're responding to the community better through open communication and being very transparent and being very open to being adaptable. And then in turn, parents are more willing to tell us how we can adapt, be supportive in this adaptation, and then always on our side when we're moving kids.
So much of this is grounded in a vision of deeper teaching and learning. Describe for us just briefly what that means and your hopes for the students in Fleming County.
Yeah, so deeper learning really goes down to really means that authentic real world, right? What we're trying to do in partnership with our community and our parents is make learning more real world, that's more relevant to kids, that they understand why they're learning through their context, and not because it's a standard in a book. It's because it's important that they learn these critical concepts or these skills, and especially develop and acquire these durable skills that they can be competitive in the workforce. But it's really about changing more, less textbook, more real world, and more learning based on the kids' interests, passions, and aspirations, and really allowing their talents to really shine through. And that's going to be challenging, Bridget. I mean, I told principals and teachers for a year now, what we're getting ready to do over the next 3 years is seismic. And it's going to challenge us in ways that we've not been trained to handle. There's no roadmap for this, but we know we've got to do this because it's the right thing for kids. And, you know, if we can do that, it will make our community stronger in the long run. And then hopefully this catches fire and really strengthens Commonwealth. Look, I think the Commonwealth is doing remarkable things right now, but we've got to think 5, 10, 20, and 25 years. We've got to have our kids now preparing for that so this success continues so that the Commonwealth will stay strong. And look, I wake up every morning excited. I see what kids are doing. I see what teachers are doing. And I see that passion that the parents and the community wants for the kids. And I tell people all the time, I've got the best job in Kentucky because of that.
Dr. Brian Creisman, Superintendent, Fleming County Schools, Kentucky, thank you for joining us on Eastern Standard.
Thank you.
Sun Behavioral Lexington is an outpatient center for people, including children, who are working to recover from substance use and mental health disorders. They've been in a partnership with Fayette County Schools for just over a year and have now expanded to Clark County. CEO Jason Statz is here with us. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Jason.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
And first, if you would take a moment, some background on you, Jason. Am I correct that you grew up in southeastern Kentucky?
I did, yes, in London, Kentucky.
In London, okay. And you're an EKU grad?
Yep.
I think master's in clinical psychology.
Correct, yes.
So you have in the past headed a multi-hospital system in central Ohio.
Right.
and then a private psychiatric hospital for active duty military and their families.
Primarily, yeah. Mostly treated active duty at that location.
And so what brought you to Sun?
So what brought me to Sun is when I was in Ohio, I encountered Sun as a competitor. They have a hospital there and Columbus, and it was a direct competitor. And in working with them and getting to know your competition out there, I began to learn about their values and their beliefs toward patient care and the way they approach care. And prior to that, I had a hospital in Western Kentucky, and I treated a lot of patients from Northern Kentucky at my location, hours away. It's 2.5-3 hours away. So around that time, Sun was being built in Northern Kentucky as their primary location in Erlanger. And, you know, when I heard about it, I thought it's a fantastic resource and it's much needed because people are traveling to get care. And so as I left the state, Sun was, you know, building the hospital there. And I became more aware of them and paid more attention to them as a competitor because of them coming to the state before I left Kentucky. And when the opportunity came open and started talking with some of the leadership within that company, I was attracted to, one, coming back to, you know, where I consider home, and my wife from are both from Kentucky. And so being able to come back home and also join a company that is centered in the values that speak clearly to me, and, you know, a very patient-centered approach. And SUN stands for Solving Unmet Needs. And as I got to know the company, you know, specifically in Kentucky and what I would be taking on if I were to come into the position, learning that we had a campus in Lexington that had just opened, and that being where I lived for a number of years, and really know the need here and know that it's a much needed and underserved resource need here in the local area. So those are the driving factors that really, you know, pushed me to join and come on board.
Well, let's talk about that need. We hear reports that mental health is becoming more and more prevalent. I don't know if that's because data is now catching up with reality or if we're experiencing more mental health issues in our society.
I think part of what you're referring to, maybe it's more visible now and it's more public now than it's ever been. And I think it's because people's lives and inner thoughts are a little bit more public than they have been in the past, with multiple modes of getting that out there. But I think mostly with social media, people are sharing about their experiences and they're sharing about what they're going through, not necessarily calling it a mental illness or a symptom they're experiencing, but the world is getting to see more of the true day-to-day complications that people encounter. And I think the media is now covering mental health in a way that they haven't in the past. So I think our eyes are more open to what may have always existed that may have been silently a need in the community, that now we're just seeing it more. And as we get more visibility, I think it changes with where our world's at the given moment.
Well, we're talking today about children. We heard coming out of the pandemic that there was quite a bit of damage done during those years. And that kind of intersects with the rise of social media and digital devices and digital natives. Is there something there that's causing problems on the school level?
So I think the pandemic in multiple ways really impacted the way we operate as a society. But a lot of things that we get from school or kids get from school aren't necessarily taught in the classroom. Those are just the products of being there, that you learn those soft skills of interacting, of interpersonal skill, sharing. A lot of those skills that get us further in life and that we use on a day-to-day basis but weren't formally taught because you got that from the physical interaction and the socialization. When you remove that piece of it and people are remote, and during the pandemic when kids are sitting at home doing maybe catching up and really staying up on the technical skills or the online learning or the actual test itself, they're not getting the interaction, the redirection of the teacher, the softer, less rigid and not necessarily focused on as much as an actual skill. So I think what we're seeing is some of the impacts of that and the kids struggling to be in the classroom. And part of it may be results in ripple effects of the pandemic.
So these school districts are partnering with Sun to provide these services. Is that something new, or is there precedent for that kind of partnership?
It's not necessarily new. There have been others to do it in the past, but I think it's more of a need now, and it's hard to sustain. It's hard to pull off because you have a private entity that's partnering with public schools, and we're really operating, in our case, on their campus. So it requires a lot of collaboration, and it requires both sides to be open to the dynamic. It's usually not an easy crowd that we're treating or addressing. So there's always going to be some complications. Things aren't going to go as exactly as planned day to day. And if the partnership isn't just right, it really keeps the whole thing from going well. So I think that's why it's not done a lot, is because it requires a very tight communication and partnership between the school and the entity, which would be us. And why we chose to, you know, this most recent partnership with Clark County was we were excited to do it because it went so well with Fayette County. What we saw as we start to talk to these teachers and the mental health departments in the school system, they are so passionate and so ready to be part of the solution, but they don't quite have that resource of the solution. And in particular, Clark County is a good commute from the resources of those services otherwise. So those kids, to get the level of care that we're providing, they would have to miss school altogether and travel. And then is that sustainable for the number of kids that need the treatment, the number of kids and sessions that they need? So the only way to make it accessible in the way that it's going to really work for their community was to have it local and in the school system. And so it was surprising in a great way to see how dedicated the school system is there in Clark County. And who knows, we may end up developing into more than just the elementary that we're in now, but we're fresh into it, and we feel like that partnership is right for what we need for this to work well.
So in Clark County, it's kindergarten through fifth grade.
It is.
Fayette County, it's middle school.
Middle school.
And do you anticipate, as you just alluded, do you anticipate expanding out of those age groups?
Yeah, possibly. And I think there's no reason that we wouldn't. We want to make sure that we're doing well before we expand it. So in Fayette County, we've started to talk about other populations. We're open to that. As soon as we get more stability under our belt and a little bit more time with the current programs, I would venture to say that we'll see some more development.
What kinds of cases come to you? What kinds of services do you provide to school children?
Most all of our programs are group-based, so this is no different. The two school programs that we're operating now are about 4 hours of treatment groups per day in school. Our staff are doing skill building, the mental health treatment. We have a psychiatric provider that sees them and does medication updates if needed weekly. And then we partner with the school for the remainder of the school day that they're doing the required education portion so that they're not falling behind. Actually, sometimes they get ahead on the schoolwork that they're working on. So we have them for a portion of the day, and there are some overlap with the teacher, and then the teacher has them for the rest of it.
And does it make a difference that this is taking place in school as opposed to being taken off campus to an office somewhere?
Yeah, in some ways, we're trying to mirror what we provide in our setting. We're trying to mirror that in the school. What's different is the amount of presence and buy-in from the teacher side. If they were to come, for instance, to our site here in Lexington, we have these same services there. And if we have a school-aged child that comes to our Sterlington Road campus, they would see a teacher probably, I think it's the home hospital would have them doing 1 hour twice a week with a teacher to get caught up on those things. But otherwise, they're considered approved absence from school for a medical need, as if they were admitted to a hospital. So I think the difference is that, one, they're on a campus that they're familiar with. They don't leave the school setting to an unfamiliar setting. So they're a little bit more receptive to treatment, and you have more integration of the teacher that's working with them. And we can translate more to that setting because we can just, by chance of being in their setting, pick up on, well, this is how we really have found that we approach this kid best, and translate that to the teacher in their setting or see their interactions more. And I think that partnership between us and the school system is stronger than it would ever be if it were on our setting alone.
What kind of outcomes are you seeing?
So we measure change scores. So we have some instruments that are in place to see what their symptoms are when they come in and what their symptoms are when they leave. We're fresh into the child program in Clark County. We are measuring that in all of our programs. So what we would like to see is that kids come out with stronger skill sets than what they came to us with. So what we would do is identify or inventory the reasons they're not doing well in their day-to-day life, and each kid may be different. So one kid may have some real issues with transitions, and they can't transition from one subject to the next or one thing to the next, where another kid may have some explosive outburst, and they're working on like a different skill set for each of those two kids. So the outcomes for us would be a significant or clinically significant improvement of symptoms, whether it be one thing or another, that we've made a difference in that particular need for the kid. So it's a little individualized, but we do overall change scores, measuring, you know, how the symptom is at admission versus discharge. And so that's really the measure that we mark, has this been effective for the patient that comes on board with us.
All right, that's Jason Statz. He's Chief Executive Officer of Sun Behavioral Lexington, and we thank you so much for coming in.
All right, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Would it have made a difference to you if, when you were young and trying to find your path in life, somebody whose advice you valued told you to simply be yourself? Roberta Davis does that for girls of color growing up in Lexington and the surrounding area. Roberta is the founder and president of Operation Be You. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Roberta.
Thank you, Tom.
So tell us about Operation Be You. How did it get started? What inspired it?
It actually got started because as I was growing up and I had worked in manufacturing for 35 years. And as I was going up through the ranks, you know, I always thought that I wasn't really good enough. I always doubted myself. And I never had anyone growing up to really mentor me or say, hey, Roberta, I think you would be good at this or good at that. Everything that I did was trial by fire. And it wasn't until I got in my late 20s that everyone else seemed to see this leadership skills that I never knew I had, because growing up, I didn't, you know, have those type of people around me. And so as I started going through the ranks, you know, through my career, I always said, when I retire, I want to start a nonprofit for girls, because I didn't want them to grow up and not, first of all, feel valued or not have anyone to point out some of the good attributes that they have at a young age to where they could blossom, you know, a lot sooner than I did.
The girls that you work with are between 10 and 17, prime years for feeling insecure, uncertain about so many things in life, and not feeling that self-esteem that you were struggling with. How do you help them?
Well, I help them through mentoring them, because Operation BU's mission is that we want to improve the lives of these teen girls. And, you know, the majority of them are in marginalized communities. And we develop life skills, and we do this through, you know, increasing their self-confidence, making them feel like they belong. They grow this bond with each other as well as, you know, our team, and just embracing them where they are, and just teaching them skills to, you know, for lifelong success.
And talk to us about those skills. What kind of life skills do you teach them?
We call it our five P, which is our five pillars, teaching them how to overcome fear, you know, getting them out of their comfort zone and letting them know it's okay not to feel okay. And we teach them how to do that, what that feels like, and embracing, hey, it's okay to feel this way and get through it. The second pillar is to be heard. It's, you know, that effective communication. We teach them the power of words, body language, tone of voice, social media, everything around communication. Our third pillar is mindfulness. That's physical mindfulness and mental, you know, mentally with everything that teen girls are going on with. And you said it with the self-esteem. You know, we have to constantly be reminded how to control that, because we're looked at and depend on, you know, how we're seen in public, how we act, you know, we are given, you know, certain labels. The fourth pillar is being motivated. We, you know, teach them how to motivate themselves, how to be self-starters. And the fifth pillar is SMART, which is an acronym of social skills, money management, how to be accountable, responsible, and trustworthy.
Now, where does all this take place?
Well, starting this year, we teach one of our programs, A Journey to Find Me, in two elementary schools for teen girls. But for the cursive writing clinic and other activities, we primarily use the public libraries, since they are free to nonprofits.
Well, if somebody listening to us wants to help out, or they want to know more about your program, where can they find you online?
They can find me on our website at www.operationbu.com. Or they can email me at admin21operationbu.com.
That's Roberta Davis, founder and president of Operation BU. Thanks, Roberta. Thanks for what you're doing.
Thank you so much. And I really appreciate you reaching out to me, because we would be glad to have all teen girls in our program. I really appreciate you.
Thanks for joining us. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer, Neil Kesterson, sound designer and technical director, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. We're online at esweku.org, where you can check out our archive, our series, our partners, and sign up for our weekly e-newsletter. You can find Eastern Standard on weku.org, on the WEKU app, and podcast versions are available on Apple, Spotify, Buzzsprout, and the NPR app. Want to call something to our attention or suggest a topic? Our email is es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.